Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, your host. Know, O honored guests, that far from being mere literary relics from a bygone age, the heroic tales that first emerged in ancient times in and around the Mediterranean Sea are alive and well today. Indeed, they are thriving in our modern world. The Olympic Games, instituted by the Hercules of Thebes to honor the 12 immortals, are now celebrated worldwide. Transpersonal psychologists have taught us how to detect and interact with the Olympian archetypes that reside within our own psyches. And tale tellers, using media undreamed of by our ancestors, still recount the past, present, and future exploits of the Olympian deities, demigods, heroes, and fabulous beasts. Now, my friends, release the concerns of your current reality. Relax and enter the realm of timeless tales. Welcome to the mythic world of sword and sandal cinema. And we begin with Legends of Hercules. It is never wise to defy Father Jupiter, especially on Mount Olympus and in front of the other Olympians. Yet this is exactly what Hercules does. His father's thunderbolts cast him forward and toward the mortal realm far below, which is, incidentally, exactly where Hercules wishes to be. Rescued by the sea by a merchant vessel, he soon finds himself in New York and begins his adventures in earnest. His sidekick and guide is a pretzel vendor, aptly named Pretzi, who cluelessly tries to acculturate our favorite demigod during his sojourn. Hercules meets lovely Helen and her scholarly father after providing instruction to local athletes. He woos her as he battles an escaped bear and earns a name for himself in the colorful world of professional wrestling. Jupiter sends Mercury to fetch his errant son, but Hercules refuses to return. Olympus is boring. The mortal realm is full of exciting possibilities. The All-Father, affronted, sends Nemesis to conduct Hercules to the underworld, where he's to remain for 100 years. Juno, who has never liked the fruit of her husband's loins, commands Nemesis to take Hercules' super strength and to leave him where he is. Banishment to Pluto's realm doesn't sound like much of a punishment to the Queen of Heaven. Our hero, shorn of power, finds himself running afoul of weightlifters and gangsters. Venus and Mercury send Samson and Atlas to lend a hand, and Hercules emerges triumphant. Having seen that his company placed his friends in the way of harm, Hercules bows to Jupiter's wisdom and accepts his banishment. Jupiter, having followed his son's exploits, decides that it's time to revisit the mortal realm. This was Arnold's first movie and was prophetic in predicting his future political career. There was an exciting chariot race through the streets of the Big Apple, and actual Greek music served as the score. Both the dubbed and undubbed versions are enjoyable, and I greatly appreciate all the small touches that kept our hero in the Olympian pantheon in a Greco-Roman context. Onward, this movie was called Hercules in New York. Sometimes Hercules goes bananas. And now we proceed to Ron Carson's Colosseum with Ron Carson and Andrea Tutrani. Greetings and welcome, O Colosseum owners.
Good evening, Hercules. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Not too bad. Is my partner in arms present and accounted for?
Your partner at arms
Absolutely.
Is present and accounted for.
Hello, sweetums. How you doing?
23 Skidoo, I'm ready to go.
We are ready to go, and the curtain goes up on another classic sword and sandal film. Of course, everybody is ready and waiting to check out the big show. Proper social distancing guidelines have been definitely implemented over here, and today we are going to touch on the fall of the Roman Empire.
Ooh, awesome.
Absolutely. Too bad I couldn't get to see it because I did try to look for it, but without any options on what I get for TV channels, I was unable to watch it. But I did find the synopsis on YouTube, so I'm pretty well informed. So let's go. Let's get this started.
Let's get this show on the road, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, we're talking about a film that was released in 1964. It was directed by Anthony Mann, and some of the big names on this particular picture included Sophia Loren, Stephen Boyd, Alec Guinness, James Mason, Christopher Plummer, John Ireland, Mel Ferrer, Omar Sharif, Anthony Quayle, just to name a few. So this was an all-star cast in more ways than one.
And, of course, being a musician, I have knowledge that Dmitri Tiomkin wrote the score, who was quite a popular score writer back then, as John Williams had become through the Star Wars and Close Encounters era. So I was a big fan of his. Yeah, he was very, very popular, and I was a big fan of his music back then and still fabulous.
Well, being that you also partook in musical concerts during your heyday, Andrea, you know? Well, I guess he was a major influence of yours in more ways than one. And ironically, this movie just was not a moneymaker. This was one of the poorest grossing sword and sandal films to date, even though we had an all-star cast. It encountered a $16 million budget, and the box office total in its first year release only reached $4.8 million. So that was pretty much not a good ratio.
Wow. And it was a lot of overhead because everything back then, of course, you know, was not computer-generated. So all of those thousands of people you saw in the crowds were actually thousands of people in the crowd.
Absolutely. And I just want to make mention that this is not a documentation of the final fall of the Roman Empire. It was pretty much the onset of corruption and decadence, which led to Rome's demise. If you remember when we were quarterbacking, Andrea, you actually mentioned that.
That's correct. And you are aware that this movie, the 2000 film Gladiator, was somewhat of a takeoff on this film.
Yes.
Making the Gladiator theme being the main theme, whereas in the original 64 film wasn't the main theme, it was just a portion. But definitely a strong connection there, and the theme was used in the 2000 film.
Absolutely. I mean, very good contrast over here, my partner in arms. And as a matter of fact, the movie also deals with the imperial politics of Rome, along with the natures and limits of two words that are pretty much staples in everybody's vocabulary, loyalty and friendship. So that was pretty much the test of time in this particular picture.
That was. They seem to have made the characters not quite as intense in their roles as they did in the 2000 film, which was closely followed. For example, Commodus was kind of happy-go-lucky and funny, a funny character, but I think Christopher Plummer was the Commodus character, whereas we all know that Joaquin Phoenix was absolutely brutal in his portrayal of Commodus in the recent one.
Very good parallel over here. Absolutely, Andrea. I mean, you hit the hammer and the nail on that one for sure. And the title role of Marcus Aurelius was portrayed by the legendary actor Sir Alec Guinness, as a matter of fact. Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Right.
We're talking about Star Wars. How ironic.
Help us, Obi-Wan. You're our only hope.
Yes. May the Force be with you in more ways than one. But the opening scene of the movie has Marcus Aurelius in labor to keep German tribes from invading the northern territories in the Danube, and his deputies are of Greek descent. One of them is Timonidis, who was played by the late, great James Mason.
Oh, wow.
And this is where Stephen Boyd steps into the picture as General Gaius Livius, and he pretty much is in love with Aurelius's daughter, Lucilla, played by the ever-popular and lovely Sophia Loren, who still looks fantastic for her age, this day and age. I mean,
yes,
she's just still a goddess in my eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. She really hasn't changed. She's definitely
not at all
gracefully.
She has aged totally gracefully in more ways than one. And ironically, when this movie was featured in the Cannes Film Festival, that 1964, mm-hmm. she actually made an appearance in the ceremony, and she came in on a chariot, believe it or not.
Hey, wow.
Dressed up in the outfit that she wore in this role as Lucilla in the movie, believe it or not. And she was an instant hit, believe it or not.
I would imagine so. Wow. I wish I could have seen that.
Yeah, I wish we would have had a YouTube clip of that entrance at the Cannes Film Festival, because it really would have been so, so mesmerizing to see. And go ahead, Andrea. Go ahead. Did you say, something?
I would also have loved to have seen that. Mesmerizing is a good word. She's, that would have been fabulous.
Mm-hmm. And by all means over here. Now, unfortunately, Aurelius met his fate by Commodus's cronies, you know, because he was an evil character in that particular picture, if you recall. And
yes.
Unfortunately, Livius wants to, you know, has like a one-on-one with Commodus throughout this movie, too. And in more ways, like, again, the politics of this movie are pretty much is what the focus is, as favoritism towards Rome and all the provinces in Italy, and then pretty much the domination of each area trying to be of equal status over here.
Mm-hmm.
And Livius invades the Roman Empire and scores a very big victory, capturing the German chieftain Balamar and his aides in this particular scene that we're talking about here in the movie. And the role of Balamar was played by John Ireland, out of all people, too. Another big name movie
star.
Wow.
And Anthony Quinn was one of the all-star cast also.
Anthony Quayle we're talking about, not Quinn.
No, Anthony Quayle, right. And what character did he portray?
Anthony Quayle, as I'm looking through my notes over here, was Varulus.
Okay.
He was Varulus over here. And in order of the army to penetrate into Rome, Livius is reliant on a speech by Timonidis, which helps persuade Rome's Senate to let the German captives become peaceful farmers on Italian land. And the basis of all this is that, Commodus sends Livius back to the northern frontier, and Lucilla goes to Armenia, and she gets paired up with a king named Sohimos, who shares a loveless political marriage with her, believe it or not. And that was played by Omar Sharif.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Pre-Dr. Zhivago.
Like I said, and pre-Funny Girl.
That is correct. That came years later. Dr. Zhivago was released in 1965, I remember. And the bottom line is
fabulous.
That fabulous without a doubt. I mean, this movie was also within that same realm, which I'm going to get to toward the end, but I'm just trying to accent more of the highlights of this particular picture, as the rebels now are fighting the Persians instead of the Romans with Livius, and they try to vanquish Sohemus. And, of course, Commodus is back in the picture again, as he wants to give a co-emperorship to Livius, but he turns it down, believe it or not. And because of that, Commodus wants to pretty much sacrifice both Livius and Lucia, that they be burned alive as human sacrifices. And he's not really much of a nice guy, this Commodus, if you noticed.
No, he always has to be a bad guy. And
He is pretty much a big first-run villain in this. And he actually liberates Livius because they go on a duel for the throne, and they have the all-important javelin scene, you know, when they're in the arena and they're fighting in javelins.
Oh, That's right. And doesn't somebody get killed by accident? I don't remember.
It was Livius over Commodus. Livius wins the battle in this one.
Right.
But he passes the emperorship because it looks like Livius is in love with Lucia, and the basic thing is that the premise of the story is the Roman Empire was not fallen immediately, but then its corruption, like we were talking about yesterday when we were programming and quarterbacking this, led to the country's immediate collapse. So you, of being an Italian descent, must be very familiar with the mechanics of this particular part of history.
That's right. As we had discussed, it's funny that there's not a Tutrani in there somewhere, because my heritage does go to Rome, and my father did trace the Tutrani name back to the mid to late 1400s with a bishop in the family, and that's how the Tutrani name began. And believe it or not, the only living Tutrani male is my grand nephew. So,
no kidding.
My brother, my nephew, three generations. My brother, my nephew, and my grand nephew are the three last Tutrani men. So they need to. Yeah. That's really amazing, isn't it?
I would say that is very, very informative, and very, very historical in nature, that you also have this connection. I mean, I think there's a little peplum in you over here, Andrew, which I never knew about.
Well, we always used to joke around and say my father was a barbarian, so maybe it's more than
I... Do you hear that, Hercules? That's one of your magic words, barbarian.
That is one of my magic words.
My mother used to say that. Before we go off the topic of peplum films, Hercules, I have a question for you.
Sure.
I recently watched a film called Pompeii, which was just a few years ago, I think maybe 3 years or 4 years ago. And, of course, and it is the genre of a peplum film. Now, if it's from this time within the past 10, 20, 30 years, is it still a peplum film? Only because it's new, or does it have to be in the 60s or earlier?
No. Although a lot of our fans love those early peplum films that came out in the late 50s, early 60s, there have subsequently been peplum films. Nick Dyack, who's one of the hosts on our Thorn and Sandal cinema shows, he wrote a book called The New Peplum, and they placed the new peplum era after Gladiator. So anything after Gladiator is the new peplum.
That's a question I had.
We cover all peplum, even comic books, video games. If it has anything to do with Greco-Roman or other ancient cultures, we'll cover it on the show.
Okay, great. Thank you for answering that. Ron and I had discussed that, I'm sure.
So we have a new angle on this. Anything past the new millennium is considered new peplum instead of classic sword and sandal, as Hercules just referred to right now. But when we show movies at the Coliseum, we like going into the older genre, because I'm a live in the past guy, and I like bringing back the classics to our cinema over here. And we have a very good response with our audience whenever they're attentive and very much into revisiting all these movies that we haven't been to or seen or heard from in quite a long time. And this Fall of the Roman Empire movie pretty much did fall through the cracks, because it wasn't one of the most popular peplum films. It didn't reach up to the level as a Ben-Hur or a Spartacus or the Ten Commandments. But the bottom line, it still garnered an all-star cast, and even though it didn't fare out as well at the box office, it still got a very good reception from audiences. And critics kind of gave it mixed reviews, but it wasn't really much panned, so to speak.
Right. And also, just to add to that, there's still no comparison to watching a film back then and a film now, yes, okay, all the special effects are nice, but after 20 mm-hmm. minutes of watching the same explosion, it's like, okay, enough already, especially if the acting is poor. You know, so if the poor acting with a lot of special effects, it gets kind of, you know, tiresome. So I understand completely what you're saying about how there's no comparison with those movies back then as today. They're not even entertaining.
I'm definitely in agreement with you on this, Andrea, for sure. And I'm sure Hercules also feels the same way. But, you know, he likes to touch on different subjects, and I'm kind of glad that he pretty much clued us in on this new peplum genre that pretty much is now being pretty much visited by, you know, the younger crowd. And it's pretty good because at least now they're getting an idea of what the classic sword and sandal films were like in our days. But nothing beats the originals, in my opinion, as opposed to the newer material where you said the special effects are just there. But I think when you were making the movies that we're used to, they were basically real, and they were basically pretty much more involved for the audience in more ways than one. Now, this was a long movie, actually. It was actually 184 minutes in length, believe it or not, which included the overture, intermission, you know, the whole nine yards where they take a break and go out and get snacks, smoke a cigarette. So those were the days when you actually get able to get up for about 15 minutes in the theater and stretch your legs and wait until the second part comes on and you're with anticipation wondering what the rest of this movie is going to offer. And it's kind of lacking these days in movies of today, in my opinion, in more ways than one. Hercules can relate to this one, that the movie made a big premiere in our old hometown of New York City. I'm sure Andrea remembers the old Cecil B. DeMille Theater on 47th Street and Broadway.
Oh, absolutely. That's where I saw the Ten Commandments.
Oh, really?
Yes, with my parents.
The irony on the theater named after the director.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, they don't make movie theaters like that anymore. They were single cinemas and the stage and the big screen. I mean, oh, my goodness. I mean, I told you stories about the RKO, Andrea, when Hercules and I used to go and watch all our classic movies just down the block from where I lived in Washington Heights. I mean, that cinema was just absolutely golden in nature.
And
you remember, Gus?
Yeah, of course. And the name of the show, some trivia, comes as much from the RKO Coliseum that was that theater you're talking about, as well as the old Coliseum in Rome.
Correct. That's why I pretty much call my feature Ron Carson's Coliseum, because it's very, very near and dear to me on a personal nature, being that I didn't live too far away from the vintage RKO theater that had the same name in my old neighborhood. So I kind of keep the legacy of the RKO Coliseum alive in this feature once a month, and I'm proud to do so because, you know, I would say one thing about our youth, and Andrea, you could relate to this as well. I mean, we all lived through a very, very good time in life, and it's nothing like it is right now. I mean, we'll take the 20th century any day over the 21st. Would you be in agreement with that?
I absolutely agree 1,000%. Absolutely. Yep, you're right. When you're right, you're right.
All right. Well, I'll take that as a humble compliment. But ironically, the movie was released in 64, but they began shooting this in January of 1963. And it was done over across the pond in Europe, as interior scenes were in a studio located in Madrid, Spain, the Samuel Bronston Studios, and they also used the Cinecittà Studios in Rome for other interior scenes as well.
Wow. Yes, yes. I remember they mentioned that in the documentary I saw that said the buildings were stationary. That wasn't a Hollywood set. That that must have been impressive to see that. I would love to have seen that in person.
Well, they had 8,000 extras for soldiers, 1,200 for cavalry, and they also used a total of 1,500 horses throughout this motion picture, believe it or not, from Spain and Portugal.
Fascinating.
Very fascinating. And like I said, it took them about 143 days to shoot this movie before it was released the year after. But they also added an extra 2 months for the action sequences.
That was actually quite fast. It takes them longer to film now. Sometimes it takes 2 years to film something now. 143 days is quite fast.
Everything was more fast-moving back then, if you remember. In this particular, in these particular movies. I mean, I'm pretty sure that, you know, but when they're making a movie right now, they weren't really, you know, more of like on a set time limit in the old days on how to make a movie, and their budgets weren't as big. But when you're talking about a budget of $16 million in 1964, that's a lot of money back then.
It is a lot, yeah. And then again, there was no editing of the film after. It was they did a shoot, and that is a take, and that was it. They didn't have to
edit
anything.
In more ways than one. Yep.
Nothing like the old days, huh? Nothing like the good old days, like you said.
Nothing like the good old days. I just want to also give you another footnote on the musical, on the music of this movie. It was recorded at an arena called a theater called the Royal Albert Hall.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've never been there, but I've heard about it.
That's why I dropped that into you, because of the fact that you were in, you know, enlightening us with the musical direction of Dmitri Tiomkin. So I wanted to add that as a footnote to the feature, and the editor of the music was George Korngold. He was the son of Eric Wolfgang Korngold. Do any of those names ring a bell for you?
No, not Dmitri Tiomkin, yes, of course, but not Korngold, no.
All right, but Dmitri Tiomkin was very, very instrumental in doing a lot of musical direction of soundtracks back in the early days. And
yes,
the movie was nominated for one Oscar in 1965, ironically, Andrea, for Best Music and Score.
Wow, how do you like that?
But Dmitri Tiomkin did not win, but he did win a Golden Globe a few months earlier for that same category.
And on that note, we need to start wrapping up. We only have 5 more minutes, so I'd like you guys to conclude and share your contact information.
Oh, okay. That's very good. See, time sure flies when you're having fun over here in more ways than one.
And you guys did awesome, so I'm looking forward to future segments.
Absolutely. I mean, the prospect of having Andrea as a co-host of the Coliseum is truly a bonus on both of our parts over here, Hercules, because she adds so much enlightenment to the show in more ways than one, and she also threw some angles at me that I didn't get a chance to put on my notes. So kudos to you, sweetums.
And I'm learning an awful lot from you gentlemen, so I thank you very much.
Awesome.
Well, it is our pleasure over here. Now, ladies first, give us your contact information so how they can get a hold of you before I do mine.
All right, okay, I can be found on Facebook at Andrea Tutrani. There are other Tutranis, but I'm the only Andrea there. So, just inbox me or friend me, and I'll be ready and waiting. And that's the best way to reach me. So go ahead, Ron.
Sounds good. Well, you know, in my platforms, you can hook up with me on Facebook. And, of course, you can also hook up via the radio station that I work at up in Berkshire County, Massachusetts, which is WSBS AM and FM in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, where I'm the midday and Saturday morning host. And I look forward to everybody tapping in online at WSBS.com. We also have the free WSBS app available at your App Store or Google Play. And that can be downloaded to a tablet, smartphone, or mobile device and take us along wherever you go. Our motto there, we are portable. And you can also scroll down on our homepage of the website to the Listen category, WSBS on Alexa or WSBS on Google Home. And eventually you can get step-by-step instructions on how to install the smart speaker device. And this way you have plenty of options to listen, whether online or on the app or on Alexa. And If anybody's in with the sound of my voice that's within South County, Massachusetts, northwestern Connecticut, or eastern New York, we're found on 860 on the AM dial, 94.1 FM. Truly drop in, because it's always a really, really big shoe, as Ed Sullivan used to say.
Very cool.
I love it.
If you can send me a list of all of those links through personal message or email, I'll make sure that every time you have a show, I post them all in the thread promoting the show.
Absolutely. And I understand that our good buddy Brian, who runs the Drive-In Theater, is coming up next, and he's got a really awesome Facebook page. I'm sure he's going to tell you all about it when he gets on the other side with Hercules to discuss it. And I always like to push this group because he's a slice of Americana. It looks like because of the pandemic, we got a taste of that nostalgia back by bringing the drive-in theater aspect to people that were yearning to see a movie. And he is like a treasure trove of information, and he keeps this piece of Americana still alive. So by all means, we look forward to having Brian chime in, and go on his Facebook page, give it a like, and you'll be glad you did.
And thank you both very much, and I look forward to the next time we're together. Take good care.
Love you too, Hercules.
You.
Love you, Andrea.
Love you both. Stay well, gentlemen. Stay safe.
All right, Kalinista, everybody.
All right, Kalinista, and now I have some announcements. Nicholas Dyack, author of the new Peplum, and also on our station, the co-host of Scholars from the Edge of Time and our Sword and Sandal Cinema Specials. He has on his site, nickdyack.com, Peplum Roundups, where you can go and check what's new in the Peplum world, not only in the movies, but in the comics and in video games and all sorts of other forums. One of his books has recently been released, The Many Lives of the Twilight Zone. So although it has nothing to do with Peplum, it's a really good book. One of my books has recently been released as well. I have a chapter in an anthology called Alien Lives Matter, It's Okay to Be Gray. So that's released also. While we're shouting out to people, we'll shout out to Peplum Paradise, which is hosted by Stephen Smith and Nick Whale. Peplum Paradise is dedicated to Peplum, Sword and Sandal, historical and fantasy movies, with an emphasis on those films produced in Italy in the 50s and 60s, which is what Ron Carson prefers as well, and Andrea Tetrani. Any posts relating to these films are welcomed, and any off-topic posts or advertising will be deleted. They also have a companion gallery page on Facebook. While we're shouting out again, I will shout out to the Historical, Epic, and Colossal Movies group by Glenn Folkford. He has a forum to discuss, share, and inform about epic historical movies, about Romans, barbarians, medieval kings and queens, Vikings, and even epic Westerns. But you're free to post pictures, video, not full films, though, links to reviews and news. Historical for this group is defined as movies set in the year 1899 or until the year 1899. Please stick to this definition or else we'll end up discussing history from 1985. Some very wise words. And now we're going to listen to a song, "If the Mighty Elohim," and next we'll be back with Brian of Brian's Drive-In Theater.
Oh,
Greetings and welcome back to Sword and Sandal Cinema. And now we join Brian Walker of Brian's Drive-In Theater to learn about Sword and Sandal collectibles. Greetings and welcome, my friend. How are you?
I am well tonight, Hercules. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. The folks are giving a lot more feedback on the podcast, and I'm getting a lot more potential guests. So it's been very busy trying to organize all that.
Well, that sounds fantastic.
Yes, it's awesome. So I'm really, really happy, and the groups on Facebook are growing, and people are interacting more. So it's a great day for Sword and Sandal Cinema.
Yeah, and you know, as we as a culture, well, as a world, you know, begin to come out of the the pandemic situation, I think that things might all of our spirits might be lifted.
I think so as well. I'm forever an optimist, as are you.
And tonight I wanted to talk about some of the movie memorabilia that you can find out there.
I can't wait to hear about it. I collect a couple of memorabilia as well. And there's some memorabilia that I'd like to have in my collection, but it's prohibitive in terms of the cost. So I always remain alert for things like that because you never know. Someday you might go on Amazon or one of the other sites like eBay or Etsy, and there it is for an affordable price. And then I swoop down with my PayPal, and it is soon in my hands.
Well, obviously eBay is a great place to look for memorabilia, especially if you're looking for something very specific. I know that Sergio Chiani is your favorite Peplum star, and I wanted to see. I mean, I actually have a few pieces of Alan Steele, otherwise known as Sergio Chiani's the film memorabilia, and it's nothing fantastic, but I have some lobby cards. In America, lobby cards were usually 11x14 in size, and they were usually printed on like heavier paper, not necessarily cardstock or anything like that, but something that could be sent from movie theater to movie theater and perhaps even survive. You can find lobby cards in a lot of places. To tell you the truth, when it comes to looking for stuff like this, if you want some of the old promotional material, but you're not all that picky about, actor or film, you can find a lot of that stuff, at flea markets or which is probably becoming increasingly rare, or some of the antique malls that you see, especially in the area that spans from where you live in New Jersey, across the region where I'm in right now, like sort of the Pittsburgh area, on over, because that's traditionally, the Rust Belt.
Mm-hmm.
And populations in the Rust Belt decline, and that's typically where you find some really good memorabilia, and usually the price isn't so bad either. The dearer a piece is, the more expensive it is. For example, let's say like an original 1931. One sheet of, let's say Frankenstein from Universal Studios, that's going to be really expensive and it's highly collectible. But on eBay right now, there is a one sheet of Samson and the Slave Queen. It looks to be original. Now, I couldn't swear to it, but it says it's fair to good condition. It's only $25.
That's not bad.
Well, no, it's not bad at all, because there are some original lobby cards which are also $25 a piece. So in this case, the one sheet, which and what size they are, they're 27x41, so they take up quite a bit of real estate. They take up quite a bit of room if you decide to have one framed and hang it up. But, I mean, they're huge pieces, and if you do have, a nice expansive wall, they're perfect, for something like that. Now, the issue there, and one of the reasons that I think that sometimes the one sheets really don't cost any more than some of the smaller sizes is that they are more difficult to frame. There are sources, on the internet, even in Amazon, where you can buy ready-made framing for one sheet.
Uh-huh.
It's not inexpensive, however, and it's nothing you can go down to your local, Michaels or one of your local picture framing places and just pull one out. And if you do decide to have it framed, it's going to cost a few $100s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to be exactly cheap. But the media itself is probably not going to cost too much. And, if you do invest in a nice frame, and let's say you have, let's say, four or five one sheets that you really like, well, you can just sort of rotate them because they all came folded when they were sent from movie distributors out to the theaters. So you can carefully fold them back, hopefully without doing any damage to them. I'm the proud owner of a number of one sheets, and since they do fold down, like I said, if you do it carefully, you can fold it down to something kind of manageable, about the size of a lobby card, really, or pretty close to it. And so for the sake of storage, it's not really that difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some other sizes that are pretty easy to find. Ready-made frames for window cards, for example. Those are 11x14. It's pretty easy to go down to your local framing store, and you can find them already, assembled and ready for you to take home and put whatever it is you want. And oftentimes, those old promotional photos that were, actual printed photos and often accompanied news stories, that were supposed to be planted into, newspapers whenever the movie showed up in your town.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those can be kind of pricey, though. I mean, those are usually like $20 to $25. And, given the nature of, the photographic paper, sometimes finding one of those in really good condition is a little tough because, old photographs, get bent, they crack, and a lot of what you find out on the market are actually reproductions. If you're a purist, the way I tend to be, I bristle whenever I think that I've bought something original only to figure out that it's a reproduction. So that would probably be my lecture there is to, make sure that if you are a stickler for having, your original memorabilia as opposed to reproduction, just make sure you know what you're getting. Most of the time, I don't really have that big of an issue with reproduction, as long as I know that it is one, and I've got a few reproduction pieces. Yeah, but sometimes they look great. They're freshly printed. The ink's popping on them. A lot of the old pieces that I have around the house, and my whole house is sort of covered up with movie memorabilia, as you might imagine. Some of the older pieces that I have, if I haven't carefully placed them in my home, the sun will kind of wash them out. For example, and this isn't peplum related, but I have a signed photo from Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and Donna Winter and Kevin McCarthy had both signed it. Well, I had it in a particular spot in my living room where the sun came in, and it really bleached out their signatures. You can still see that they're on there, but it's not, it's not that bold Sharpie look that it once had. So that would probably be another part of my lecture. Know what you're getting, but be careful with it too. You know, some of these things, they weren't meant to last this long. They were meant to be used, you know, for, you know, let's say, you know, 7 or 8 weeks of a run of a film, and then they could be thrown away. You know, they didn't really have any long-term use, and it's amazing the stuff. You know, when you do find it has lasted as long as it has, because it was just made out of paper. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, the construction material on it was, you know, done to a price. and sometimes, you know, the they were a little sparing with some of the inks that they would use, especially with the B movies. Oftentimes, you know, technically, I guess the image would be in color, but they wouldn't use the full spectrum of red, green, and blue. Sometimes you just got blue or red. And it would save a penny here or there. So that, you know, if you are looking, you know, for something to decorate your walls with, and you are flexible as to, you know, the type of film, you know, that it represents, oftentimes you will just gravitate toward the image itself, but some images are better than others. I mean, I've got a pretty extensive collection of lobby cards at this point. Even within a set of lobby cards, they usually came 8 to a set, sometimes 9 if it had a title card. Some low-budget movies might have only had as few as 4 because they're, again, you know, budget's everything. Even within some of the sets, oftentimes, you know, the image quality will vary, or, you know, one image in a lobby card set might be worth a lot more than the rest of them if they're parted out, you know, if they're separated, because let's say, you know, a lead is featured in one of them. I've got some lobby cards from one of Gordon Scott's peplums, and right off the top of my head, it doesn't, I can't remember which one of his films that it was, where he only appears in one of the 8 lobby cards that in the set that I have, which is kind of crazy because he's the star of the film, but he's, you know, there's really only one good picture of him. There's a few that are sort of way in the distance, and then there's like 3 or 4. There are like 3 or 4 of them that actually feature, you know, some of the other cast members, which is kind of strange, you know, in a way, because, you know, he was the big star in it. And, you know, when I got that lobby card, so I was kind of disappointed in it because I thought, well, gosh, there's only like one really good picture of Gordon Scott here, and then the rest of it's these other people. I'll have to go back through my collection and see which film that is. I used to have one of the lobby cards from that set displayed in my house, but I rotated it out a while back. I just can't remember which film that is. And another, I'm sorry.
No, it's amazing what type of things human beings get into collecting. As you pointed out from the poor colors used, these things weren't meant to be collected. They were meant for like fast advertisement on the cheap. But because they're a thing in and of themselves and they have meaning that transcends what they're originally intended for, we've made them into treasures.
Well, one of the oldest pieces that I have in terms of movie memorabilia, and I've been collecting memorabilia since I was a kid, probably let's say late 1970s. Years and years ago in an antique mall, I can't even remember where we were, I picked up an early 1930s day bill. It's a really strange size, and I would love to frame it. But I haven't quite figured out what kind of frame would look best in it. The image itself is still hanging together, and like I said, it's from 1931, so it's 90 years old. So it's amazing that it's still with us. And the only way I could really date it was I had to look up the titles of the films. Some of these things, you know, a couple of the big titles on it are lost. You know, there's no existent copy of it. One of them's Dracula, but Bela Lugosi's Dracula ran you know, for years and years and years. So that didn't really date it. I had to look at some of the other movies and some of the short subjects that were mentioned on this day bill. It's, you know, like I said, one of my prized possessions. I love it. It's got great colors. But, you know, for me, I haven't framed it because it is such a weird size, and I just can't quite, you know, get it straight in my head as to what kind of frame I want for it. I'd like to, mm-hmm. It's got some orange in it, and I would like to have a frame that, you know, kind of made it pop. But you really have to watch the sizes if you do want to display this stuff, and if you want it, you know, very neatly framed, or maybe if, you know, sort of a, you know, a frameless clip frame, if that'll do, then it is kind of easy, you know, if you can find something of the size that you need in order to mount it on the wall. Now, there are some movies were distributed with window cards, which are 12 by 36. If you don't mind putting the frames together yourself, you can make a frame and then have some decent glass cut for it.
And we're going to have to do a part two because we only have a few minutes left, and this is a very fascinating topic, and now you've opened the door to it. So we have to keep exploring. What do you recommend for people who are thinking about collecting these things? How would they start their collection? You talked about eBay and then going to different, like, antique type of stores. What else can they do? Like, to learn
Well, one thing that I would suggest is, especially if you're looking for Peplum titles, don't just mine eBay.com if you're listening to us in the United States. Go to Italian eBay or French eBay. All you have to do is replace .com with IT if you want to look at the Italian eBay. You will find stuff there that you cannot find here. And that's because, you know, those movies were produced largely in that area. Now, if you do want to display them, just be aware that, you know, our standard sizes are different than their standard sizes. So make sure you get an accurate measurement. Also, for some of the European sizes, oftentimes people overlook IKEA as a place to get some framing pieces.
Well,
because, you know, it's done in centimeters as opposed to inches, and that's the way a lot of the movie memorabilia that you buy out of Europe is sized.
I never would have thought to look there.
Yeah, it's an old trick of mine that I stumbled upon about 25 years ago. I was wondering, you know, why is this piece so oddly sized, and where am I going to find a frame in America to get it? And then I was at IKEA one day. I thought, oh, that's about the same size. So actually, it made it pretty easy. So that would be my tip of the day, I suppose. If you are looking for something, you know, like a Peplum film, and you're okay with some of the European images, some of which are beautifully done, you know, way more attractive than what showed up in the States, quite honestly, way more detailed, really beautiful artwork. You check eBay from other countries because you'll find some real treasures there.
And how would people contact you and visit the drive-in theater?
Oh, well, getting to the drive-in is really easy. You can just run a search for the Many Faces of Hercules at Brian's Drive-In Theater in your favorite search engine, such as Bing, Yahoo, or Google, and that will take you to the website. Also, if you're looking for me on social media, the easiest place, the best place, I should say, to find me will be on Facebook. There again, if you have a Facebook profile, you can just run a search for Brian's Drive-In Theater, and I'll pop up.
Incredibly awesome. And I checked out the Drive-In Theater, and you have Thor and the Amazon Women showing there. I haven't seen that in a while.
No, and you know what? I thought I had run it over the last year because we're now a full year into Movie of the Day as opposed to Movie of the Week, and I had not run it. I was really surprised. I thought for sure I had. So I thought, oh, today's the day.
Well, I'm glad you're showing it. I don't know if I'll catch it today. I still got like a bunch of things to do before bed, but I can dig it out of my DVD collection and watch it over the next couple of days. Brian, always a pleasure. Thanks again, and I look forward to talking to you very soon.
Okay, we'll talk Monday.
And thanks to everybody who joined us today. Whether you listen to us talking live or whether you're going to join us later on demand, until next time, from us to you, joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And we only have seconds left, so I won't play a song. And maybe I should plan longer shows or ones with less segments in them because lately we've been running out of time more and more easily. So anyway, take care, everybody. Talk to you soon.